And now, your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Hi, everyone. It's Dean Haglund. And as the song said, this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And I'm here with your co-host, Mr. Phil Lernis, ladies and gentlemen.
Always wonderful to be here in the historic Eastern Columbia building. Always. Who was the architect?
Claude Beelman, the genius of Los Angeles. He did numerous buildings and then also did the Wiltern over at Wilshire and Western.
That's beautiful.
That's gorgeous. And he did the post office on Ivar in Hollywood that he did with another architect. So he actually did his solo buildings, plus he would work very well with other architects.
I believe that post office was a location in Karl Rove, I Love You, though I can't swear whether it made the final cut.
Ah.
Because it's been quite a while.
Since
I've seen it. You know, and sometimes you do forget when you do these things what made it in the film and what, you know, what didn't. Though, of course, there is a big European release or worldwide release coming of Karl Rove, I Love You. So I guess I will watch it again.
Again.
And that will be fun. So strange to be talking again about a film made 2007, released in 2008, set in 2004, and here it is 2012.
That's weird.
It is, I guess, especially, I mean, you've seen the film, you know, when President Obama was first elected, people would say,
oh, too bad.
Too bad Obama's in for you because
you didn't
now,
get that Karl Rove thing.
Yeah, that Karl Rove, it's not timely anymore. Right. It doesn't really have anything. 4 years later, it's like, oh my God.
I know. And he's on TV more than ever as a spokesman and a pundit.
And we're realizing what kind of, collectively, what drew me to the project in part in the first place, which is it's not a... Karl Rove's not
the issue.
Singular, except maybe in so far as his effectiveness. But there's many, many Karl Roves. There is a Karl Rove inside us all. Your Karl Rove simply has a song in his heart.
That's right. It's that easy.
Did not mean to plug that, but I was excited to learn that I shot at a historic building in downtown Hollywood.
See that? See, it all comes back to Claude
Beelman. And now, podcasting from a historic building by the same architect in downtown Los Angeles.
He's the connective tissue that binds us all to Los Angeles.
Us all. Everyone listening.
Who are bound by Claude Beelman architecture.
Welcome
to the show.
No matter how you are listening to us, whether it be on Jackalope Radio.
Jackalope Radio, Fridays at 7.
Jackalope. I think we're also rebroadcast and available for downloads there as well.
I bet we are. Those guys got it going on.
TalkSuperStation.
Yes.
.com. Whether you listen to us at our website, Chill Pack Hollywood.
Yes.
Whether you subscribe to us via iTunes or Really Simple Syndication. Or... even listen to us on MySpace or Facebook.
You can do that.
There are players there, and you.
I know, and we're still on MySpace.
Oh yeah, we are.
I know.
Have a blog each week on MySpace, myspace.com/chillpackhollywood, previewing the coming week's show.
Is this some sort of loyalty to Rupert Murdoch? Is that why we still?
Well, you know, we keep hearing these stories about the hip makeovers of MySpace, and
I'm waiting for that. Can hardly wait.
And instead, it turns out to be quite unhip comb overs. I just did a little something there.
That, I don't know if that's a hack on Rupert Murdoch.
I don't know what it is.
Was it? I don't know. I didn't look at his hairstyle.
Yeah. I don't know. I wouldn't even know that Rupert Murdoch owned it if it weren't for you constantly telling me that.
Oh, okay. Awesome. What are we doing this week?
Well, you know, we've already gotten all the places where you can see us out of the way.
Yes.
We've gotten our websites out of the way.
That'll end the show real quick.
The one thing that I do want to mention at the top, because we have several emails from listeners that
we're
going to bring up. And that's what we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood.
Right.
We'll talk about whatever the heck it is you want us
to talk about.
Send
us anything.
Send it to chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We love getting comments on Facebook. We love people who follow us on Twitter. We read what you write to us on what you tweet to us.
What you tweet.
You're at D. Haglund.
I'm at D. Haglund.
I'm at Phil Lernis. The best way, though, if you really have something that you want us to discuss and think about for the show, please write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. I bring this up because I unfortunately don't know off the top of my head or in my memory, my addled memory anymore, who it was that sent this. But we got a link to an article about secrecy, about the population's current paranoia, and tracing it back to Roswell. There was a news article, and we got a link to that. and I can't find it. And I don't know who sent it because, again, we get material in so many different ways.
Right.
How many emails do you get a day?
Dare I count? I have 2,000 on my inbox that I'm still sort of dealing with in some sort of filing system.
So we made chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com because that's the one where we know if something comes there, we're not going to delete it. We are going to read it. We always know that we can find the important thing for this show
right there. So easy.
So please do that.
So there was a link to a Roswell thing and you can't find it.
It wasn't going to be our whole thing. It's just that's the one thing that did slip through the cracks. We'll talk about it.
So if you're listening, send that link again to somewhere where Phil can find it.
Chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. You can find it.
I can find it too.
That's our shared email address.
I'm really busy.
Oh my God.
But not too busy for the show.
For the fans.
Exactly.
We did get, like I said, several emails that we'll discuss. And one was just, I think, in the wake of Aurora, Colorado, and just much of the upheaval in the world coming to us from a listener in Europe, one of our German listeners, where, according to her, the financial system has completely collapsed. So, the end of the world as we know it.
German government is dedicated to propping up the euro no matter what, regardless of how many other countries drag that down, be it the bankruptcy of Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland.
Her comment in this email about the financial system collapsing was a little bit of an exaggeration, in jest, perhaps. Or just indicative of and illustrative of the rest of the email where she talked about how hard it is to break out of negative thoughts.
Oh, yes.
And one of the things we exchanged, she and I, in an email was this idea that, and it's almost counterintuitive, and it's really tough to train yourself into doing, but the first step, it seems to me, of freeing ourselves from that almost unbreakable daisy chain of negative thoughts we can find ourselves in is to not judge those thoughts, to not have negative feelings about our negative thoughts.
Right.
To not go, oh God, more negative thoughts. Why do I always have negative thoughts?
Yes, exactly.
And then you've perpetuated more negative thoughts about yourself. Try to get to that point where you greet them as, the negative thoughts are here, as if they are other guests to the party.
Exactly.
And just try to find, fake it until you can make it, faith that those thoughts serve in some way.
Right. They balance out the shadow to the light and all that sort of thing.
And maybe they do have insights to offer that you can't really grasp because of the tone in which they are expressing themselves.
Well, always comes back to tone.
It does. I mean, messages, the same message with the same intent will change dramatically depending on the tone.
Absolutely.
Right? And we know this in art so much that...
And we know this in bar fights. I don't like your tone, mister. How's that, right?
Okay, so
isn't that what the first...
So suddenly, thank you for redeeming my shameless plug for Karl Rove, I Love You, at the beginning, which again, I didn't mean to bring up, but this is why, actually, when you think about it, it's not just the political circumstance of, okay, we may be aware that there's lots of people like Rove. I think it's also the fact that now, 4 years after the film came out and 8 years after it was set, it... at least one of the reasons that it seems relevant or at least enjoyable, you know, is because of the tone that we captured.
Right. Yeah.
And that's what allows it to be rediscovered, years later.
Yeah. Theoretical political context.
And it is what, can strike us when you see a movie on opening weekend and maybe it really fits the mood that you're in. And then you come back to that movie later and you go, I don't know what I saw in that.
Well, an excellent example is Blade Runner. Blade Runner failed at the box office, but gathered steam as its tone matched the futuristic reality that everyone was seeing and going back to it and having it more relevant and more resonating.
Our friend Ethan Dettenmeyer of Combat Radio, who you will hear from a little bit later on in the show, he... really took Blade Runner to task on a recent episode of Combat Radio, and it was fascinating. I don't want to
reiterate.
Yeah, his argument it was very well stated, and I had to walk away from it because I I love the movie, but yeah. I walked away from it saying, "Boy, what he said about it is true," and it does not affect my love of it, my enjoyment, but. But it was wonderful because his argument, he was absolutely right about what it failed to him on the level of action as an action movie.
Oh, yeah.
And he pointed out that if Ridley Scott made it today, the film would have opened with the escape, the off-world escape, as a big action.
A big action sequence.
And he's absolutely right. That is how Ridley Scott would go back and remake it. But the movie works for me on truly the level of poetry.
Yeah.
Because of the tone.
Absolutely. And I never thought it to be an action film in the first place,
right.
Even though Ridley Scott's now considered an action director.
Right. And so for us, it works. For him, it doesn't work. And
right.
Neither of us are right or wrong. We're all right.
Well, exactly. I always think that about Gladiator, that one, you know, Russell Crowe, and he's in the prison.
He hardly met her.
Gladiator? That's horrible. No, but the whole third act is like, okay, gather my men outside the Rome. I need a legion of 40,000. We're going to overtake Rome. It's going to be this massive battle. And I'll escape from this prison, and I'll go four steps, and then I'll be captured by two guards.
Ethan had Nicole Laporte. I mentioned this last week. She had the wonderful journalist Nicole Laporte, who wrote the book, The Men Who Would Be King. And in that book, it's fascinating how much Russell Crowe hated that movie. Hated doing it. He didn't believe in it. He didn't, you know.
I could see.
So, which gets us back to negative thoughts.
Right.
In
here we
interesting
go.
Ways. So we understand this, the tone of it. So the first thing to try to free yourself is to, look, you know, don't judge it. You've got to break the cycle. And
right.
You break the cycle by not judging and being negative towards your own
negative
thoughts. Again, this idea that we could be gardeners of our own consciousness and don't get freaked out about the weeds.
Yeah.
If you focus on the weeds and the weeds, your garden is a failure.
Right.
Right. But if your responsibility is to the whole garden, to tending to the whole garden, well, weeding and pruning and these, I mean, it's part of it.
Part of the whole thing.
It's
the deal.
But I was curious. So when you find, especially in your work and maybe in your painting or comedy, yes. Right? I mean,
stand up for sure.
Stand up improv. I mean, I've seen you before a show and I wouldn't say they're necessarily negative thoughts, but you do go into the doubt of it.
Well, yeah, you do. Well, you need that as energy to take you onto stage. Fear, stage fright, these things, these butterflies in your stomach, allow you to sort
if you
of
can channel them.
Channel them in a proper.
What about painting? I wanted to. Hmm. And this was what I thought was interesting. I don't know. I'm going to make a thesis,
okay,
and you're going to tell me where it was accurate. It might have been about something else entirely. I have a second guess.
Okay.
But I was wondering, when you, a couple years ago, set the intention to do 100 canvases, 100 paintings.
It was really close.
Missed it by, okay,
by 70, but yes.
But you set that intention for yourself, was in part the intention set to overcome issues or thoughts that might be negative or might be judgmental towards your own work, things so that you would have to move through those quickly,
yeah.
Because it doesn't look, I hear you, the voice of criticism within myself, I hear you, and you know what, I've got to move on to the next one.
Right. The best analogy is like factory work. You know, when you're making circuit boards or miniature iPhones in your factory in China and stuff like that, you're not considering each one as a precious work of art, but you have to churn out, you know, 50,000 motherboards a year. So it's a factory. So you're going to keep that line moving. So to give me the goal of 100 paintings was the idea that this wasn't judging this one motherboard that's at the factory. And go, oh, did I solder that quite right? I could have soldered, made that diode a little better, you know, and sit there forever on that, as one can do. You can obsess on the smallest details on this stuff, as opposed to thinking in a larger scale that if I get 100 paintings out, then I can have some, not be worried so much about the microcosms of it, not the minutiae that one can get bogged down in when working on a piece.
When in my own experience, when sometimes, especially over the last 10 years, when I found myself with that constant nagging discontent.
Right.
And you can assign it to different things. Mm-hmm. But really, the older you get, you start to just go, boy, this is just an energy I'm holding, this nagging, just, gnawing discontent.
I don't need it.
I'm not enjoying the taste of
yes.
anything. And it does lend itself to negative thoughts and to all these judgments. When I was younger, I used to go looking for answers.
Right.
That. And one of the most freeing things I realized was, no, it's just, what I'm really looking for are new questions.
Ah.
Looking for new questions.
Yes.
And I thought of that while you were speaking because of that, I think it was a landscape class that you were going to be taking in, or seminar in Austin recently?
Austin, Fredericksburg, yes.
Fredericksburg. It was supposed to be a landscape class.
Right, originally.
Weather did not permit. So the whole structure of that changed.
Yeah.
Now, the landscape class, was that, if it had come off the way that you had thought?
Right.
Am I wrong in thinking that that alone would have pushed you out of your own personal comfort zone a little bit because of the type of landscaping and everything?
Yeah, it's a lot of trees and rolling hills over there. Yeah. Which I don't tend to do. I do a lot of urban landscapes and that kind of thing.
And so you'd already made kind of this announcement, hey, this would be fun. I'm going to commit to doing something that's a little bit different than what I ordinarily do.
Yeah.
And then that didn't happen at all. And it became indoors. It became a
portrait.
A portrait.
Yeah.
And the portraiture work you were doing was unlike any kind of portraiture work I'd seen you do, and really any kind of work I'd seen you do.
Right.
Which was so outside your comfort. Was there ever during that week, were there ever negative thoughts of, oh, fuck, the weather's not going to allow us to do the landscape. Oh, this is going to... I mean, was there ever anything?
No, because he actually... the way Kevin Bielfis, who's the instructor, approached it is that you treat portraiture as you would treat landscape. You look at these features not as as elements, as form, as color, as shadow, light, dark values, and get away from the idea of it's a face. Oh, I got to make this face look like this person. Once you get into the idea of pictorial elements, then it became the same as painting a landscape, as painting someone's portrait.
Well, there's another idea then, you know, prone to negative thoughts, if you find yourself vulnerable to the possibility of negative thoughts, you know, do reach out to an external voice that
can reevaluate
a teacher that in whom you do have faith.
Right.
And because that, exactly, that was how he described it and how he compared it. I mean, that allowed you to just step on into the change. It's like good direction, right? I mean, on set, how often have you felt cast adrift because, okay, we're going to change things and do it this way? Whoa, wait a minute.
Why?
That changes the whole heart of everything that
we're doing.
I understood that we were doing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
A good director might be able to say, no, you're absolutely right. The heart of this is still the same. If we come at it from this, you know, whatever it is, to show you how it's...
functional.
It's still functional. As opposed to being cast adrift. So,
right.
You know, when you can, that's why it's important to if you can be in a position to get to choose the jobs with directors that you
want to work with.
But,
yeah, exactly.
But teachers, yeah. But, you know, do seek out teachers who can give you that voice. And teachers come in many forms. Do they not? They're not just teachers in class.
Right.
We are all teachers potentially to each other. So,
right.
I, as you know, took an acting class this month to get out of my comfort zone. And
how was that? Was it just a month long?
It was 4 weeks of this process with this one scene. And it was very nice because we ended it last night. It was it was a lot of fun. And I confessed to David, to the teacher, because he pulled me aside afterwards and said something very lovely to me that I could now receive.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, well, that's really nice, because when we started, I was terrified. And I went home after the first one and the second one, even kind of wanting to quit.
Right.
Not because
you thought
I had negative thoughts, not because I thought I was doing bad or I was failing.
Right.
For me, it was far worse than that.
Worse than failing.
Because I'm okay with doing something that doesn't
sucks.
Work.
Yes,
doesn't
you're very good at sucking.
Thank you. It's a way station.
Yeah.
What I'm not, what's the biggest challenge of all is to step out of your comfort zone and to have no idea. To have no idea.
The void.
To be free of, to not be able to even have negative judgment.
Right.
I was going home, you know, how do you know if you're any good? How do you know if this is good? I mean, all I can rely on is people saying, oh, that's good. But I mean, really?
Really?
Relying on external as opposed to some sort of feeling of, oh, I found this. This is work. This is good. And what was thrown back at me was, of course, direction that I've given in the past, which is right, wrong, good, bad. Don't enter into this.
Right.
It's, you know, moments of truth. Do I believe it? Do I
right.
do these
is
things?
It false
and
or
I was
is
saying,
it true?
Dear God, I never want to say that direction ever again. That's wrong. That's stupid. There's got to be a way to know, you know, and all this sort of stuff.
No.
By rehearsing this past week, which we did out in public. We did the scene in public to see, hey, can we get past, you know, can people just think, oh, this is two people having an argument. This is two people having a conversation without, this is two people practicing a scene.
Right.
And there were moments when I realized when we walked away, oh, people walked by, people were watching us. Because my partner was aware of that. And I hadn't been aware of it.
See?
And it got real for me sometimes.
Yeah.
That didn't mean that it was good or bad or it felt, but I went, oh, right. And so last night when we shot the scene.
Oh, you actually didn't put it on
and
video.
I was given direction and I could feel, and apparently this came through, three entirely different performances given on the direction. You know, I did. And what felt great about it was it was fun to do.
Right.
That's and right. I knew, obviously this is a class, but I walked away going, that was fun, and I gave the editor choices.
Yeah. Which is a classic acting thing to say.
And isn't that... Well,
yes.
And I felt so good because as a director, that's what you want. That's what I want. I won't say that that's what directors want.
Well,
I can't speak for anyone for me.
Yeah.
But as a director, yeah, I want the actors to have fun. And I want choices.
Yeah. And not everybody wants that because I know directors that have edited the whole thing in their head.
Right.
Particularly writer directors, when they've written something, they know how the movie is. They know how every scene should be played. And that if an actor is going off on tangents,
absolutely.
Per se, they are somewhat disturbed because that is going to be outside.
It's not what they want.
It's not how they would do it.
Right. It's not whatever it is. You're absolutely right. And no two people are the same. Where I got to with it, which felt really good and was kind of the intent behind doing this in the first place, was to get out of my comfort zone. And I believe I'm someone who can give good direction and can help actors modulate and adjust performances. But it's another thing to be in their position and to know that vulnerability. And to then have to go, oh, it's all well and good that I'm giving them great words.
Right.
But how does one embody it and what do they go through?
Right.
And then to achieve for myself the thing that I want for other people, which is that sense of fun and the freedom to give choices. I hit my intent of doing this class, but I had to get through such terror and fear to do it.
Right. And probably the good thing is you didn't assign a negative value to the terror and fear because then you probably wouldn't have finished the class.
No, I knew that that's where my work was. Okay,
right.
That was the announcement that this is. And like you said, it was energy.
Yeah.
It did give energy. And this would be the metaphor that I would take for it. You know, it is a wonderful thing in film where... Just create choices, and we'll fix it in post.
Exactly.
Not that there's anything to fix, but we'll create it in post.
Absolutely.
And by the way, that's really how we tell the story of our lives. We get very wrapped up in the drama of what's going on in our own head.
Yeah, right.
And then we look back on it and we go, oh, boy, you know, that miserable experience... I'm really grateful for it because look what happened during it.
Exactly. The good things that come out of it.
Or whatever. But we weave a narrative with our lives.
Yep.
That then, and the more narrative we have, either the more gracefully we move into the future, or sometimes the more we go kicking and screaming into the future.
Yeah.
It just depends on what narrative we've been weaving.
It's true.
Which comes back. To tone
a
lot.
Exactly. Your tone of your narrative. Fantastic. Boy. What? That's how we start the show?
Wow.
That's amazing.
That was a good start. Hey, yeah. Briefly, yes. Let's hit...
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
A couple live events of the week.
Live event of the week.
I went and saw the... I don't think I mentioned this last week, so I'll just mention it again. I went to see Stoneface, with French Stewart, directed by Jamie Robledo at...
Sacred Fools.
Sacred Fools. And many cast changes. It's extended so long. There were many cast changes. I saw it with many... understudies, which almost made the performance all the more extraordinary because, as you know, the timing and the physical nature
of
this
and jumping on the trampolines.
To plug in an understudy almost made it was certainly less polished in certain, there was a little bit of mess sometimes, but it made the achievement more impressive. I mean, sometimes when you watch Buster Keaton's movies, there's almost a tendency at times to take for granted
that physicality and all the...
Like with Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy. The gracefulness.
It makes it look so easy.
It makes it look so easy and it's so, so hard.
Yeah.
But I just got to tell you, no matter how long I live, this performance by French Stewart is going to be one of the handful of the great performances I ever got to witness.
Wow.
I mean, it's really...
It's one more month.
The role of a lifetime. And, you know, as we've talked about sometimes with some of these actors, like Andy Griffith recently, who died, no matter how much you think you know an actor, no matter how much you even love that actor, because French Stewart is beloved for so many different roles, there is so much more to these people. And it really brought me to tears at the end, just the knowledge that I'd seen a great actor
doing
everything. And so it's something. It's like for people who have not seen you do improv,
right? And same idea,
and in some of the very same ways, because you incorporate all your movement training in these improv shows. It actually becomes in many of the shows, it becomes one of the really important set pieces.
A lot of physical comedy. There's not a lot of physical comedy done these
days. But not just physical comedy, literally movement comedy.
Right. Yeah. It's rare to see.
It's
particularly
it's,
in the realm of stand-up comedy these days. Yeah. You know that everybody just stands around in front of a microphone and it's sort of, lazy talking about ideas they had and then...
So I really wanted, and I saw again, and you saw this weekend, closing weekend of Where the Great Ones Run. We've talked about this before, Rogue Machine. What were your thoughts?
I loved it. I was very impressed by all the performances. I loved the writing, and I was shocked at the full frontal nudity. I, of course, was right at the side at that stage door where that happened.
It lasts a lot longer when you're on that side. Because sure when the actor ducks behind the counter.
We get the beeline of that.
Yeah.
And there's no
escape.
There's no escape in it.
My favorite line came from, I think, 16-year-old Kevin Baker, who called me after seeing the show, said, I was so excited that there was full frontal nudity, till it turned out to be a dude.
Yeah, those seats that are right by that door where he enters should have with Samu the killer whale, like a splash zone, should have just, this is the shock zone. Like, if you're going to sit in these red seats, be prepared.
A show full of comedy, full of pathos.
Pathos.
Tears.
Acting.
Jesus.
Lovely music. The song was
really
tender at the end.
Oh, and he was in the final performance. Jeff Kober, actor, China Beach, wonderful actor. He has lived many lifetimes, and it all comes to bear in this performance.
So great! Like, how else would you ever cast that with?
And he stumbled at some points in the song yesterday because he was so emotional. I mean, imagine that show on a closing.
Oh yeah,
and. I was weeping uncontrollably through the whole show, and I'd seen it a couple times. And he was
really
getting
good.
Clenched up.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time, fascinating, everybody walked away going, that's the best he's ever done that song.
Is that right?
And it was the messiest. And
how it should
so,
be.
So, again, our negative thoughts, don't worry about things getting messy.
Right.
Don't worry about the need to keep things neat sometime. You'll fix it in post.
Even with the play.
So those are your live events of the week. Before we go to a little treat that I put together, anything new you've been reading?
I just finished the American.
I am not allowed to select books, but if they're given to me, I have to read them.
Very good. You'll be getting that one.
Is it awesome?
It is awesome. It's actually really fascinating because the snippets of all the different lives of artists and doctors that have gone through Paris for 100 years in the 1800s. And then you want to learn more about all of these. So they're like mini biographies of like about 50 to 60 Americans who spent their time in Paris. Wow. Spectacular. I think you'll really enjoy it.
I finished Miranda July's It Chooses You.
Oh, yes.
About the process that she went through. Again, here's a wonderful book about how you deal with negative thoughts.
Right.
And how people, not only artists, but people deal with negative thoughts. I mean, how she went out into the world. She just started answering these Penny Saver ads because she had somehow convinced that this would get her out of her, just moving out of her comfort zone, doing something entirely different would get her out of her creative block. And it's just, this book is so funny and
awesome,
self-deprecating and powerful and inspiring. And again, I think that the two of you are very much kindred spirits.
Excellent. Can't wait.
And interestingly, how is everything coming back to Karl Rove? I love you. A review recently about this reissue actually said it'll remind you of the work of Miranda July. And I don't see that at all, but here it is. I've been reading her and very interested in her work of late. So I did that, and I'm almost done with the Boris Karloff biography.
Yes.
And
hopefully, I'm starting.
Maybe soon I'll be reading The Americans. Is that what it's called?
American Journey.
American.
Or The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris.
Mm.
The Greater Journey, yes. And then I'm picking up a Swedish crime novel that I'll tell you the name of because it's just sitting
next
on my bedside.
Week? Yeah. Awesome. Let's take a 45-second break.
You know, interestingly enough, we had Billy Dee Williams come to the station the other day to do an interview, and I couldn't find a Colt 45 can for him to sign. I was desperate to find one. But he said that people bring everything from capes to all sorts of things for him to autograph. He says fans have all kinds of the most bizarre merch that you could never even dream up. But I started with, what's it like waking up in the morning being Billy Dee Williams? That's got to be the coolest thing. And he chuckles and goes, it's actually really rather wonderful.
See, it's that sort of modesty.
And I was like,
that's awesome.
I said, that's got to be the best answer. You know, really we had the guys from The Doors, that band The Doors, and I asked them the same question. I'm like, what's it like waking up being a member of The Doors? You know, it's like being so fucking, excuse my language, awesome. You know, and he goes, well, you know, somebody's got to be awesome like that.
That was hilarious.
We have quite a lot to get to, and we haven't talked about movies in a little while.
We haven't.
And so I'm gonna ask a question of you first.
Okay.
Dear Dean and Phil, I was fortunate enough to see Dean's panel at Starbase Indie in Indianapolis last year.
Yay.
And I remembered how he brought up Phantom of the Paradise, which I did not have to see because I won our Oscar poll
bet.
Probably, this is the gentleman writing, probably one of my favorite movies.
Really?
I was so disappointed that I didn't have the soundtrack on my iPhone that day because I probably would have raised my hand so that everyone could listen.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? I would have sang along.
Just wanted to know if either of you have seen a screening of Stephen Kessler's new documentary, Paul Williams, Still Alive.
Yes.
I missed a screening in Chicago and I hope they bring the movie back to the Midwest. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it, and I almost went not only to the screening of it, but a live appearance and performance by Paul Williams at the Silent Movie Theater on Fairfax, and we were all set to go, and I jammed out at the last second for whatever reason, but it was...
hey, by the way, happy birthday. It was your birthday this weekend.
It was my birthday, and thank you to everyone on Facebook and all the lovely messages and the pictures of the cards and everything. That was very sweet. I will.
Ethan, who you just heard, is taking you and me to Disneyland tomorrow to celebrate your birthday.
Right? And that's not my idea of how to celebrate my birthday. The last time I was
get out of your comfort zone, get rid of those negative thoughts.
Disneyland is a very negative thought.
Use it. Use the energy.
To do what?
To endure the thrills and the chills and the fear of the Matterhorn. Let's wrap up. Mike George just wanted to say that Dean's panel was the highlight of my trip to Starbase Indy last year, and I hope he gets invited back soon. Sincerely, Mike George, Phantom of the Paradise fan.
Wow, that's awesome. You know, they just showed it up the street back in May, and that was fantastic.
I want to see this film, and without even having seen Phantom of the Paradise, without ever really being a Paul Williams fan, but I want to see this, having just read, again, almost being finished with the Boris Karloff biography, and I was never really a Karloff fan, and that's not to say that I didn't like him, but I really only knew Frankenstein and a couple of the horror roles.
Mummy.
And the work he did on Broadway and all this stuff. The
Arsenic and the Old Lace.
The Lark in the 1950s where he was mentoring the next Olivier, Christopher Plummer. I mean, these stories, it's fantastic. So now I'm there. I want this entree into, again, a show business figure of whom I knew without really knowing. What better than to get to know him through Paul Williams still alive? So I'm looking forward to this documentary.
That would be awesome documentary. And then by seeing the document, then you have to see Phantom of the Paradise because that's so epic in Paul Williams' career.
Let's spend a few moments talking about the death of film comedy. The Daily Beast wrote an article about the death of film comedy saying that TED is absolutely the exception these days, that when comedies are made, they are not funny and they are not successful.
Right.
It had been since probably Bridesmaids since there had been one that was both funny and successful until, according to the Daily Beast, TED, I might disagree with the assessment that is the exception to the rule. But, and they gave some reasons why they talked about, you know, Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Everybody gets what they need on Saturday Night Live. Although Saturday Night Live has been around for 30-something years now.
It hasn't been funny for 25.
Franchisation.
That's a tough one.
Is a possibility. I think about how really good alternative, edgy, character-based comedy that you used to need to go to the movies for, you can find on television.
On television.
There's such great, we're going to talk in a future show about some of the Emmy nominations. You look at the quality of the comedy shows versus, let's say, maybe the drama shows. Each show in the comedy series is really unique.
Yeah. And web series now. There's some really funny web series that are out there. And I think this comes down to what comedy is always about, and it's individual voice. And what you lose in the studio picture is everybody putting their 2 cents in, going, yeah, I just read your script. I don't think that's funny because
The
gatekeepers.
Patton Oswalt recently did some kind of commencement address, and I'm going to try to find.
That's
but it was
right.
being told to me by Sean Parker about he gave basically the speech to two different groups. You know, at this event, he was, I want to speak to the gatekeepers. I want to speak to the content makers.
Right.
And two entirely different messages. But the message to the gatekeepers was there was a time when you had a role that was really important. Nobody needs you anymore. The good work is being done. If you want the good work to be done in your milieu, in your bailiwick,
in your
get the hell out of the way.
Yes, it's true. Because there was a time, you know, it's so funny because when I first got to Fox Network with X-Files and walked through there were still some old gentlemen in suits that would read scripts and go, Hitchcock had the same problem in the third act on Rope. You know, they had this kind of lineage in terms of script analysis, editing solutions, and all those guys are gone now. And there was nobody else who had that ability that were mentored up through this program because it all became these 23-year-old kids out in the mailroom that went to Harvard. And so now that is sort of how the industry is gate kept, as it were. And so you lose that Hollywood history of movie making, screenwriting, content creation, basically. And it's thrown back to guys who are out there in front of a live audience, honing a craft, and then crafting something that is an individual voice that doesn't pertain well to somebody else coming in that has no comedy experience, has never tried to get a laugh in front of a crowd, to then go, line on page 27 is not funny. We're cutting that.
We've been talking about tone this show. It's so delicate. It's so fragile.
Mm.
How hard is it to maintain tone when you have so many cooks in the kitchens and you've got so many different concerns other than Is it funny?
Is it funny? Right.
Does this does it appeal to enough demographic? Does it appeal to enough quadrants? Does it? And also, the bigger the economic stakes, the bigger these budgets, the bigger. It's really hard to maintain tone.
And not just tone, but crafting gags on film. This is very different than crafting gags in an improv situation, crafting gags in a sketch comedy show. This requires film language. It requires a DP. You know, I shot this thing for Kohler Taps. Wow. Do you remember that thing? And it was I'm supposed to be me and a showerhead in a bar talking to each other. And every time the showerhead talks, it sprays water at me as the way of talking. And it's two dudes in a bar. And it had funny on paper. Funny on paper. The cameraman screwed that the whole thing up.
You know, there's also something called gilding the lily.
Yes, it is.
Right?
Yes.
And what's interesting is with this movement to find people who are doing, you know, funny comedy on the web, and now we're going to move them to TV or move them to movies.
Right.
Here's where the challenge from going from
the small
web,
yeah,
to the bigger canvas, much like going from sketch, from stage to TV, is without a great deal of experience, you will fall into the bad habit of gilding the lily.
Right.
Instead of realizing you don't have to do much. The thing that, again, getting back to your improv and your physicality, you got to do some fun physical gags during the years on X-Files.
Yes, and The Gunman.
But you were remarkably still on the show. I mean, you were remarkably still. And all that energy was really focused into stillness.
Right.
Langley didn't have to do much.
Right. It was all in the voice and all that energy
and
came out.
And in the eyes.
Yeah,
and didn't have to be. There wasn't the gilding of the lily.
Right.
And if there was, the tone would have collapsed.
Well, and let me tell you, that was Kim Manners. There was a lot of smart directors that pulled me back on a lot of things.
You have to learn it because...
Yes. Because you can't even see it. You don't even think you're doing it.
Your strength can become the weakness.
Absolutely.
Because on stage, that might be exactly what it is.
Right. Yeah, and if you're too still on stage, you are lost to a giant stage. I mean, sometimes people are 300 to 400 feet back, and the stage is 60 feet wide. For you to just stand there and be very still, like you would on camera,
so there is this,
disappear.
There is this sense with the proliferation of different kind of media and outlets that you can jump from thing to thing to thing.
Yeah.
And you ought to. It's fun to explore and experiment as much as possible and appreciate that each is going to be different. Each is going to be unique. Each
yeah.
has its own challenges and can bring out of you something different. And that's why you want to go from thing to thing to thing.
And that was Buster Keaton's thing. He learned film crafting gags, how to craft spectacular, not just physical gags, but sight gags.
How about this piece in Stoneface about how his timing was taught to him by Fatty Arbuckle, who taught him how to time it to the clicks of the camera.
Right, when they were hand cranking the camera.
They were cranking it. Sound comes along.
And you can't
hear it. He goes back to Fatty Arbuckle. He goes, my timing is all off. And it's because they have to muffle. He can't hear the camera anymore.
Yeah, because the
microphone's
going to
muffle
it
because it'll pick it up. So his timing was all off.
So when sound came,
and Fatty Arbuckle had to break him out of it and tell him, "You were funny on stage,
right?
You do know timing,
right?
But you become really, you start to identify with your own strengths in such a way that when that gets lost, you feel like, well, you can't do it anymore.
Can't do it anymore." And, you know, he was one of the first to use test audiences, too, in the movie The Bachelor, where there's all those brides running around. Apparently, that was a feature-length film, not a single laugh, except for at the very end, the last five frames, he falls down a hill and some rocks fall after him. And that gets a laugh, so he uses that as the basis for the whole ending of the movie, which is a giant avalanche that he's rather face a bunch of brides. He goes into the avalanche. It's hilarious.
You know, and so... Anyway, is screen comedy dead, Dean Haglund? I always love these things. Is it dead?
It's morphed to the web, and I think it has to then, those kids who are learning those skills, those kids, will eventually come back to large screen format and take those skills with them.
It's got to be cyclical. It's got to self-correct, as you said last episode. People love to laugh. Laughs do export despite what distributors here think. Historically, that's always been some of America's best exports. And films from other countries that are comedies can do very well here.
Yeah.
We'll get into some of the changes in distribution in future shows, of course, especially as it relates to Truth Is Out There, because there's some big distribution work in the offer for that film. But one of the things that I loved reading was that in an effort to bring more older audiences to the theater,
right,
there is an outreach towards more and better and diverse foreign language films.
Ah.
Because older people
can
love foreign language films, because if they have diminished hearing, it does not affect their enjoyment of the film.
You can read the subtitle.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that something?
But anyway, so we'll talk about those things. But yeah, it was really interesting to me, this idea that
film. We also got
to this point where many of the great voices in comedy either wanted to expand into more, be bigger,
right.
And so then you get something more along the lines of dramedy in film,
yes,
which is what television used to do better. They don't really do dramedy anymore,
right?
It's more innovative and irreverent comedy, edgy comedy, but you see these character dramedies in film, and there just hasn't been the next generation to supplant them yet.
Yeah, and my opinion of Saturday Night Live is not keen. I grew up watching SCTV over Saturday Night Live, so even at the heyday of the John Belushi and stuff, I thought that paled in comparison to the heyday of John Candy, Dave Thomas, Andrea Martin, these greats that came out of SCTV that was running concurrently. And particularly growing up in Canada, you got more access to SCTV than you did to SNL. So to hear SNL as part of the problem is something I really concur with.
Right, We got a question about television and what we're watching.
Right.
So let me read this from our old friend Stephen Fowler.
Oh, yes.
Dean, then in parentheses, and Phil.
Well,
that's so great. I want that on a like on a billboard or something. Appearing tonight, Dean, parentheses, and Phil.
And
that would
Phil.
Be great.
Yeah.
Have you watched Perception with Eric McCormick?
Yes.
You have. I didn't even know you knew Eric McCormick. When was he over here?
He was
watching Perception with you. I always loved it. That's a good joke. He plays a brilliant but schizophrenic neuroscience professor.
Yes.
Who helps the FBI solve crimes.
Yes.
What do you think of this depiction of mental illness?
Mm.
Is it accurate as fictional television can ever be, or is it overly romanticized, starting with the premise that TV romanticizes everything to some degree?
Right.
Your friend in and out of podcasting, Stephen Fowler. So you have seen this?
I have seen this.
Talk
I saw the pilot. Well, okay, your first problem is that your FBI lead is a young actress, very good. Do not believe her as an FBI agent. She is maybe 23. You would not have gone through any sort of FBI training. She was cast way too young. That aside, Eric McCormick does a great job. I think this is a really great role for him. He's not being the comedic swarmy guy that he was. Swarmy?
Smarmy. He was a little smarmy.
Smarmy, yeah. But yes, he does have hallucinations that he is aware of that he's having, and he has an assistant to tell him. And these is hallucinations in the pilot, anyway, helped him solve a crime. So yes, are hallucinations helpful? As we said, sometimes the darkness, if you don't attach negative thought to it, can be what is helpful. Which is kind of a nice message in terms of mental illness. But at the same time, yeah, it is romanticized because he does... I thought Eric actually was doing certain physical and verbal traits that you do see in mental ill patients, but at the same time, there was a story to tell in 43 minutes.
In a show that where we have talked about how our strengths become our weaknesses, you know, something about mental illness, and I'll be interested to see the show. You know, the very things that can make us effective in certain circumstances will be the very things that make us prone to mental illness in other circumstances.
Right.
And the example that I often use is Mayweather Lewis, of Lewis and Clark.
Oh yeah.
Know who you know was truly an explorer, and all the things that made him an explorer, that made him uniquely equipped to chart the unknown terrains of the North American continent, much of what we still know about this continent and its species and the indigenous languages, we know because of his survey.
Right.
He taught himself dozens of languages.
Right.
And taught him to sketch, and he learned, you know, he taught himself to sketch, and he made meticulous notes, maps. Came back such a hero that he was thrust into politics. We have to run this guy. He's a hero. He's a returning hero. Here's a great idea. Let's chain him to a desk and make him governor. He ended up ventilating himself with a gun.
He
succumbed to mental illness rather quickly. And it's not a surprise, because everything that made him so well equipped to be out in the wild, not only surviving but thriving,
right,
would make him entirely unsuited to survive in
a political realm.
Yeah,
and it's desks and parties,
boardrooms
and things,
offices, and
drive you nuts.
And so I'll be interested to see. You know.
And it's interesting. It's called perception, because the idea of perception being
that which we perceive as being an illness.
Yeah,
it works can on, be a difference
on a lot of different levels. Yeah, so I'm keen, but I'm sorry that the female lead on it just wrecking it for me. But I'll give it another chance.
We need to wrap up with our final 10 minutes or so with an enormous amount of celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Wow.
He through all his life worked in documentary and short subjects, both documentary and narrative short subjects.
Oh.
But the short film was his true passion, his true love.
And you, with the hatred of short film, that's...
If I, you know, the Sight and Sound polls coming out at the end of the year, the greatest films ever made, according to both critics and filmmakers, we're going to do a version of it here on Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, where we canvass every guest that has ever been on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and we find out from them what are their greatest films ever made.
Okay.
If I was to include short films in this list, it would be on my top 10.
Really? What are some of the titles?
And it's called La Jetée.
La Jetée.
You probably know it as the film that Terry Gilliam adapted when he made 12 Monkeys.
Yes, of course.
And it's one of those things. 12 Monkeys is to La Jetée as 2010 is to 2001.
Ouch!
Not a bad film.
No.
An honorable enough film, an accomplished enough film,
right.
A fun film.
There's a story.
And one that diminishes the mystery of its forebear.
Ah, I see.
But it is extraordinary. So if you ever get a chance, there was a time whenever La Jetée would play theatrically in town in revival
How long is it? Is it only like
10 minutes? 20 minutes maybe.
20 minutes.
And often it would be paired with other science fiction films like Solaris, Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, which I love as well. But it was getting to the point where I was paying full admission price just to see this 20-minute film as often as I could.
Wow.
There was no other way to see it.
Right.
There wasn't internet. There wasn't DVD.
When you were
DVD.
A kid, yes.
So, and it's just breathtaking.
Wow.
Chris Marker, 91, still working very much up until the last years of his life.
How about that?
Frank Pearson, Academy Award-winning screenwriter and director, died at 87. He most recently was probably best known for being president of both the Writers Guild West and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences
at
different
that.
Times. He started in the 1950s writing television shows like Have Gun, Will Travel.
I remember
and
that.
Playhouse 90.
Oh, yes.
And that followed by more than 5 decades of writing seminal films. I'll just throw out some. Cat Ballou.
Yes.
Dog Day Afternoon.
Fantastic.
Star is Born, the remake, which he wrote with Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn. In Country, Presumed Innocent.
Yeah.
And even in his later years, he was working on HBO telemovies. AMC as a writer and consulting producer on a little something called Mad Men.
Oh, look at that.
So anyway, I don't often read what other people say about these. We usually share our memories. But I had to read this. This came from Phil Robinson of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Governor's Writers Branch. He said, young rock and rollers always look to the old bluesmen as models of how to keep their art strong and rebellious into older years. For screenwriters, Frank has been our old blues master for a long time.
Wow.
He's always shown us better than anyone else how to do it with class, grace, humor, strength, brilliance, generosity, and a joyful tenacity.
Wow. That's a good...
Hard to beat those words.
Hard to beat those words.
Chad Everett, actor, died at 76. This
Chad Everett?
Was kind of a page from my childhood because one of the things I enjoyed doing, my father was a huge fan of the TV series Medical Center. And so I used to like, as a little kid, watching. It was one of the longest running medical shows. Young, handsome Chad Everett played Joe Gannon on it. He had a movie career. He was very funny as the villain in Airplane 2, the sequel. He had a fantastic supporting role in which he was so deliciously vile and therefore funny in David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
Ah, of course. That's where I know him from.
So Chad Everett, 76. Chad,
what was Medical Center? I don't think I ever saw that.
Long-running, Golden Globe-winning medical show.
Like... emergency?
A doctor, a young doctor. No, a young surgeon with a heart of gold.
What? When
this was a time in the like late 60s when they were doing a lot of shows like this. By the way, I have 13 more people to get to.
So just list them up.
Maybe you ask me about Chet Everett off the air.
Okay, sorry.
Sherman Hemsley,
oh, yes.
74.
Mm-hmm.
The Jeffersons, Amen. Has there ever been a more distinctive comedic action than Sherman Hemsley?
Hilarious.
Just the walk alone. When you think of that, doesn't it bring you joy?
I mean, totally does. It laughs
like, lit up
exactly.
When I said that.
Hilarious.
And finally, we talked last week about the need to take the events of Aurora, Colorado to a certain degree personally.
Right.
And much is made and written about the person who allegedly committed these acts and the reasons behind it. We talk about celebrity deaths because, as we know, it's always so much more sad when someone in show business dies than a real person.
Well,
I'm being a little facetious.
I think
so. I'd like to take just a couple moments and mention who these people were.
Right.
Gordon W. Cowden, 51, the oldest of those killed, was a resident of Aurora, a native of Austin, Texas, a loving father, an outdoorsman, and a small business owner. Rebecca Wingo, 32, listed Joe's Crab Shack as her employer on Facebook. She graduated from Ford High School in Quinlan, Texas, and she had served honorably in the Air Force. Jesse E. Childress, 29, was an Air Force reservist and cyber systems operator, currently on active duty and stationed at Buckley Air Force Base in Aurora.
In Aurora.
You will find that many of these people were of service to their country. John T. Larimore, a 27-year-old sailor, was stationed with the Navy in Colorado, which surprised me because I didn't know the Navy had a station in Colorado.
Me neither.
And was one of two servicemen active to be killed in the attack. Matthew McQuinn, 27, died saving his girlfriend, Samantha Yowler. McQuinn was from St. Paris, Ohio. Graduated from Vandalia Butler High School in 2004 and worked at a Target store in Denver. Alex M. Sullivan had gone to the midnight screening of the new Batman film to celebrate his 27th birthday. Mm. Jonathan T. Blunk, 26, was shot to death in the Aurora Theater protecting his girlfriend. A former Navy man who served aboard the USS Nimitz in San Diego. He had been working at a hardware store at the time of the shooting. Alexander Tevis, 24, recently earned his master's degree in counseling psychology from the University of Denver. Jessica Gawi, 24, is also known as Jessica Redfield, and she had moved from Texas to Colorado to pursue a career in sports journalism.
All right.
And she's the one that had previously lived in Toronto.
Right, and dodged the Eaton Center.
Where she had escaped the shopping mall.
Yeah, yeah. The big Eaton Center. That's the major mall in downtown Toronto, right off Yonge Street.
Where a gunman shot seven people.
Yeah.
In June.
In June, no less.
In a blog entry, she described how the experience in Toronto had reminded her how blessed I am for each second I am given.
Mm-hmm.
Michaela Medic, 23, had graduated from William C. Hinckley High School in Aurora, identified herself as a Subway sandwich artist and a member of the class of 2015 of the Community College of Aurora. And on her Facebook page, she had written, "I'm a simple, independent girl who's just trying to get her life together while still having fun." Alexander J. A.J. Boyk, 18, graduated from Aurora's Gateway High School. He enjoyed baseball, making pottery, and music. His plans included attending Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design in the fall. His dream was to become an art teacher and to begin his own studio. Hmm. And finally, the youngest to have died in Aurora, Veronica Moser Sullivan, age 6. She was very proud because in the days leading up to the event, she had learned how to swim.
Mm.
Till next week.
I'm Dean Haglund.
And I'm Phil Landers. Belated.